Some of the mansions of the former lords of India are also used as schools, often for evening classes. Others serve as museums, exhibition halls, and art galleries. The art galleries which I had visited during my brief stay in Calcutta and in Bombay, had a delightful juxtaposition for religious and secular art, so that one could turn from an immensely moving religious painting to find a way out pop art canvas cheek by jowl with it. It was as I had thought. The mansion was not Satura's private address but a museum cum art gallery devoted in the main to works of ancient religious nature. Despite its wealth of treasures, the museum mansion was almost deserted. When I went into the entrance hall, I at once saw Satura. I did not see the gentleman who had brought to me the message of Satura's invitation, and apart from a sleepy attendant tucked away in a far corner, there were no other people all the time I was with Satura. He walked forward to greet me and immediately went into one of the exhibition rooms to show me the image of an old Indian god. "This is what I found of particular interest," he said, and pointed to the sacred cloth of Lord Vishnu, painted in red, yellow and golden colors. "It is proof that earlier generations have observed the effigy of our out-of-spacecrafts having made an earlier landing," he said, and pointed to the rather strange designs of flying saucers, beautifully designed onto the sacred cloth of Lord Vishnu. Naturally, this did not mean much to me, and only many months later, while in South America, by rare chance was I able to see an almost identical flying saucer image, also pointed out to me as some religious artwork of pre-Columbian gods. Until then I would have thought that Indian art forms, particularly religious antique art forms, were uniquely Indian. I was wrong. Not only then, but even later in South America, when I assumed that pre-Columbian art could be related to one and the same early civilization. Only today do I know that there is an analogy with the unknown planet Itibiratu and earlier visits by people from that planet. Of course, at the time in India I thought this out in terms of allegory and symbolism, reflecting that perhaps this Itibiratu, the strange man had mentioned, might be their equivalent of the mythical Shangri-La or the romantical nonsense. At the back of my mind was the thought that there must be a commercial reason for this invitation, and I expected some sales talk from my host. At least mentally I prepared myself. However, nothing of the sort happened. Satura did not want me to buy old religious paintings nor anything else. We spent a very agreeable afternoon together. Having viewed the interesting rooms of exhibition, we went outside into the garden. There, I was able to observe the strange man even better than during our trip from Bombay to Madras. He had the light brown skin of a Eurasian, huge dark eyes, a rather small mouth and an unusual chin line. The lower part of the jaw looked slightly deformed. Then, there were those fingertip gloves which he seemed to wear at all times, even though the weather was extremely hot. Above all, there was this peculiarity of speech, this complete reliance upon an electronic gadget to reproduce his voice. If it had not been for this, I certainly would have placed him as the religious leader of some sect, like the Trappists, who make a vow of silence. Perhaps, I thought, he had made such a vow of silence and yet had also provided a built-in escape mechanism from that vow by linking the vocal cords with an electronic speaking device that bypassed the mouth, thus giving a semblance of credence to the original vow of silence. Utterly ridiculous. But have not the early Christians emasculated themselves so that their virility would not come between themselves and their devotions to God? Others have blinded and scourged themselves all in the name of religion. For a second I thought that my host could have come from another part of India, as he had got on the train at Bombay and was making a pilgrimage to one of the holy cities of his particular religion, but then again he spoke about his home on another planet and continued to ask me questions, mostly about Europe. I was thus thrown once more into utter confusion. Also, he asked me what my name means, and told him, but then I recalled my impoliteness while being on the train. I had forgotten to introduce myself. "You know who I am, then?" I had remarked, and Satura smiled. "Most things are simple, when we analyze them. Your name was printed on your luggage tag. From Calcutta to Benares, To Google Map we continued to talk for a while and I mentioned my intention to see Kashmir in the northern part of India. Then, I said, I would travel back to Calcutta by plane and fly up to Benares, which is only a very short flight from Calcutta. That would make an excellent tour, my friend replied and added, Benares, the holiest of all cities, shall be the place where we meet again. What made him think that our paths would cross again? Maybe this will indicate our presence in Benares, he said and showed me a curious ring, made of solid gold, at least half an inch thick. This ring, he informed me, is the symbol of a human religion very close to ours. It is many times 10,000 years old. I looked at the ring more closely. In the middle of it was a minute scrap of metal that sparkled like a diamond. Mr. Satara pointed to the metal design and assured me that because of it we would be able to meet again. Then he handed me the ring and told me not to lose it. Briefly, I had hesitated to take such a strange present. We had walked across the patio of the colonial mansion to the drive that led down to the road. I know that it is unusual to say the least, to receive such a magnificent gift, especially on such a chance acquaintance, and I looked at Satara. But he was smiling gently at me. Reassured, I slipped the ring on my finger, and thanked him, inadequately enough. For the present. There was one question I had wanted to ask Mr. Satara since I met him the first time on the train. The gift of the ring, the symbol of religion, I dared to think of his regard for me, emboldened me to ask, would you please, I said, tell me your profession? Satara smiled once more. I am a servant, he replied, a servant of God, as are all my people. With that, he gave me a friendly wave of the hand and returned to the mansion. I ambled along the pavement until a taxi came my way. There is little point in describing my visit to Kashmir. Suffice it that I managed to study some magnificent temples, and enthused over the various art forms with which the temples were decorated. I do not want to seem impious when I confess that I was more interested in the ceremonial of religion than in the religion itself. I had been told so much already, in Bombay, about Benares, the holy town on the Ganges where they go to die, that I remained only 2 short days in Kashmir and flew back to Calcutta and then to Benares. Benares, I shall never forget this town, Benares. Because it was there I finally understood the true aspects of death and the very meaning of life itself. In India, of course, there is not much guessing, the ultimate meaning of life is love and death. Where there is love, there is also death. There is no escape from the two, and in order to live fully, one must at some point in life experience real love, real passionate love, and also the direct danger of death. Without an awareness of these two, life can have no meaning. Indeed, if is the vital clue to the erotica with which so many of the Indian temples are embellished. By death, I do not mean the death that comes at the end of the physical life. Death is that which looks you straight in the face, the reverse of the coin of love. Of course, this love and death that is life, do not have much in common, except, perhaps, that both passion and death pass on, for they are both in a very great hurry. In India, physical death is never very far away. Perhaps that is the way that nature orders things. The astonishing rate of increase of the population is apparently linked in many aspects to the closeness of life to death. Indeed, to observe nature makes one believe this to be true. A few miserable grasshoppers have a better time than the giant swarms, numbering countless millions, which in their fury devastate everything that comes in their path. Once they have filled their stomachs, made love and laid a few eggs, their life comes to an end. So by analogy, the more people who populate this planet Earth, the nearer that population will be to disaster. The rich nations, with decent homes and hospitals, with well-adjusted, conservatively dressed, Philistine communities, will never know what it is to have millions of starving, uneducated, super-religious fanatics running half-naked through some of the largest areas of the world. But make no mistake about it. The struggle to live of these starving millions is as violent as their death. So I discovered in my journey across the length and breadth of India, that life and death are cheap. Funereal customs are as beggarly as is life for the average Indian. The corpse, naked under a small sheet, is placed upon a stack of logs, and the fire is left to do its work. A fat old man burns much faster than a skinny old woman, so that funeral workers, attending to the last rites, mark up their price when dealing with the poor. So even in death, poverty remains a curse. But there is logic in the demand. The body burners know that the fat man's body will not need much wood. But the skinny person's body will take an hour and a half to be consumed, and a lot of wood will be needed. You simply have to be practical, even in the matter of death. You must see the problem from the point of view of the body burners. I discovered, however, many more pleasant things in Benares than the riverside crematoria, however important these might be to the religious and economic life of the community. There is, for example, an excellent hotel, the only one approved of by Western people. I checked in at this hotel, and admired not only the accommodation but also the beautiful gardens made all the more splendid by the tropical trees dotted about. On the night of the second day after I had checked into Benares and into this hotel, I was enjoying the night air in the garden. Suddenly, I noticed that the metal design in the middle of the gold ring that Satura had given me in Madras was shining with a luster that far outshone the natural glitter of the metal. It must have been a trick of the light. That is what I immediately told myself. A piece of metal just does not glow incandescently of its own volition. It had to be a trick of the light, an optical illusion. I tested out this hypothesis by moving my hand so that the moonlight and the light from the battery of lamps struck the metal design from every conceivable angle. The result was the same. That scrap of metal glowed as if it was a miniature searchlight. I even tried putting the ring in my pocket, where there could be no possibility for reflected light. The metal design, if anything, glowed even more brightly. A mental image of Satura came before me. His words, that the ring would announce his presence, flooded into my mind. The whole thing was ridiculous. It just could not happen. But there it was, happening in front of my very eyes. Up till now, I had looked upon Satura with a very open mind. If I had been a religious man, I suppose I would have been in the position of an honest agnostic. Satura might have been, or might not have been what I thought him to be, a holy mystic belonging to some small religious sect of which I had never heard, but that ring, with its metal inset shining so brightly at me, put an entirely different complexion on the matter. I was sitting in the grounds of the hotel facing the main entrance. This entrance was brilliantly lit. Many people were standing on the steps leading to the entrance. Because of my own position with respect to the lights, it would have been impossible for anybody at that entrance to see me sitting in what must have been to them the darkness of the grounds. A little after 9:30, I saw the unmistakable figure of Satura appear at the entrance of the hotel. It would have been the natural thing for him to inquire for me at the desk. Instead, he passed through the entrance out into the grounds and walked straight to where I was sitting in a secluded, darkened spot. He came to me, as though he had been linked in some way to a homing device. Satura greeted me warmly. He seemed very pleased to see me and inquired if I had enjoyed my visit to the temples of Kashmir. So I started to tell him about my holiday jaunt, took him over to the light, and showed him some photographs which I had taken on the trip. Most of the photographs had a religious motif. There were interiors and exteriors of temples, colored slides of many different effigies to the numerous gods worshipped in those temples, pictures of priests and worshippers, the whole spectrum of what one would expect to find when making such a holiday trip. My friend hesitated very much to look at the faces of the people pictured on the photos, but suddenly he must have changed his mind, and looked at them carefully before handing them back to me. "You have been there?" I inquired. "Yes, I have been to these places of worship. But you know, my friend, religion is blind. Just like love." He said this very sadly, as though he were reluctant to pass any criticisms on religion. After we had finished with the photographs, we sat down on a bench near to the main entrance where we could observe the comings and goings of the bystanders. A group of uniformed hotel servants loitered around the entrance practicing the international sport of girl watching, a pastime that is not only international but also historical. The Spanish conquistadors did it in Cuzco, the Romans in Gaul. It docks not matter one little bit if the girls are ugly or pretty, of low, middle or high class, if kitchen maid or hotel guest, men will watch them. We saw a young airline hostess, chic and pretty as a picture, walk down the stairs and have a word with the hotel manager. The girl watchers reacted as if she was the seventh wonder of the world. Satara noted this intense reaction, and smiled his amusement. What men want to do for the sight of a pretty face and figure, he remarked. It is the same in all the universe. It is a powerful force. I agreed. Why, I once saw a riot sparked off because of it. He asked me to continue. It was while I was once in South America, at a place called Barranquilla, in Colombia. I was there on business. I was in a cafe having a drink when a beautiful young woman sauntered by. She really was beautiful, in a dark, Spanish sort of way. This young lady had a remarkably overdeveloped bust. I remember that she wore a vivid red dress, and that she had tiny bells stitched to the dress. As she walked through the downtown section, her hips swiveling, so the bells tinkled away merrily. It was sensational. All the men started to follow her. Traffic came to a halt. Eventually the police had to step in and ask her to stop strolling along the street. That's when the riot started, for the men turned on the police and began to beat them up. And where were you when all this was taking place? I kept my seat in the cafe, and had a grandstand view of the riot. It crossed my mind then what a powerful force a woman could be. Why, there was a rebellion in one of the neighboring countries. There are always rebellions in South American countries. So I thought that if that woman, or some other woman with the same kind of sex appeal, could put up for president, or could be made head of a junta, there had be peace for a good many years to come. Men would just do as she told them at the crook of her little finger. Satara nodded in agreement. There is much truth in what you say. The men would be lost in admiration of such a president. They'd spend the entire day muttering. Mamazita que hermosa and que preciosidad. What a gorgeous baby. What a doll. Why, she'd be just about the first South American president to die of old age. And she'd never fear the assassin's bullet. The South Americans are even more demonstrative than the Indians over there. I jerked my thumb in the direction of the girl watchers, who were still feasting their eyes, and their imagination, on that doll of an air hostess. Some of the expressions that filtered across to me on the night air were frank in the extreme, reminiscent of some of their more realistic passages in some of the modern novels that I had read. Satara was still amused with all this. He had looked a trifle nonplussed at the starkness of some of the language of admiration, but his sense of humor took over, and he laughed at some of the more outrageous expressions. My friend had not said very much, but had contented himself with watching the byplay. I, in my turn, was fascinated by the facility with which he understood everything that was said, no matter what the language spoken. For example, we were speaking in English. I had lapsed into Spanish, which is one of the languages that I speak fluently, mainly because of my extensive business interests in South America. Then again, some of the girl watchers had broken into rapid Hindi. Yet Satara was at home with all these languages, and, I shrewdly suspected, with many more besides. I decided that the speaking gadget that he used, which looked for all the world like a very sophisticated deaf aid, must have something to do with his gift of tongues. I thought that it must be an advanced form of electronic translation device, something of the nature of the simultaneous interpreting machinery that is used at the United Nations, on a vest pocket scale, of course. But there was something also in connection with the device that puzzled me. I have said that Satara's voice was nothing out of the ordinary. It had not the timbre of the orator, the resonance of the velvety musical voice. And yet there was a quality about his voice that made the hearer feel the inner meaning of words. There is a figure of speech in which the word suggests the act. A word like crash, or bash, suggests the action implied by the spoken word. With Satara, however, there was depth of feeling even greater than that contained in these onomatopoetic words. If he spoke of pain, then you almost winced at the word. If he spoke of love, then you were blanketed in the sensation of love. It is a difficult thing to explain. The gadget gave the voice a new dimension, a subtlety such as I had not heard in any other man voice. Again, this set me pondering. In my heart of hearts, I knew that all talk about people from outer space, people from other planets, was just so much nonsense. But even as I told myself this, I remembered the ring on my finger, and the metal dot that lit up to warn of Satura's approach. Like the agnostic who has had a revealing spiritual experience, I reminded myself that I must not condemn out of hand, least of all because I did not understand the mechanics of a thing. Satura was speaking earnestly to me. I appreciated that I was being a trifle discourteous in allowing my thoughts to wander. "Did you say your sister?" I asked, latching on to the last word that he had spoken, the first word to impinge on my conscious mind for some little time. I'd be delighted. Then I will summon her. When he said this, I naturally thought that he would leave me for a few minutes, go to the hotel, and then return with his sister, perhaps phoning wherever she was from the reception desk. Instead, Satara remained seated. The expression on his face changed. It seemed as if that different chin was suddenly possessed by lockjaw. It was hideous to look at. The eyes, too, were widely dilated. Curiously, the light seemed to leave the eyes, as though someone had turned off a switch at the back of the retina. I realized that Satura was in a mild state of trance. Then, as suddenly as it had been occasioned, so the condition left him. If I had not seen the change in the man, I would not have believed it possible to change from normality to catalepsy and back to normality in the split second that it took for the sequence to be played out. Satura had not turned a hair. I for my part felt in need of a drink, so I called a servant across and ordered scotch and soda for both of us. The servant turned away to carry out the order, and as he did so, I saw Satura's sister coming across the grass to us. At least, I took it to be his sister, for there was no other reason why a most attractive lady should be advancing upon two men taking their ease in the grounds of an hotel late at night. As she approached us, I thought it was queer that I had not noticed her before she materialized in front of us. My subconscious choice of mental words staggered me. I had thought in terms of materialization. She had come from a well-lit area. I could see everything and everybody in the vicinity of the hotel entrance. Yet I had not seen her until she neared the bench on which Satara and I were sitting. I liked the way the woman walked. A gliding, undulating movement, a movement in which body and arms moved rhythmically in a way that I had only noticed before with her brother. As I rose to be introduced to Xity, I could see at once the family likeness. There could be little doubt that this was Satara's sister. There was that same different chin formation, those same compelling eyes, that same air of charm and of authority. And when we were introduced, she looked me straight in the eyes in a way that few women do. But there was no pert boldness in that look, merely fearlessness and utter frankness. Xity took a chair opposite the bench on which Satara and I reseated ourselves. Her every movement was a study in gracefulness. She was dressed in a glittering evening gown, as though she had just left a very formal reception. But although the ensemble was exotic in the extreme, there was no hint of the Oriental about it, except that her tiny feet were enhanced by golden sandals. An orange half-veil accentuated rather than hid her matchless beauty. And one can imagine that the jewelry hides the translator device that she used. "I am very pleased to be able to meet you." Her voice was a scented whisper, the pianissimo of a magnificent melody. I caught my breath as I listened to that incomparable voice. One thing at once became apparent to me. Although she was speaking normally, it was obvious that she was employing the same technique as her brother for communicating with me. I looked closely at her charming, petite figure. There, the pendant on her flawless throat, was a small bejeweled brooch. It was seemingly an exotic version of the electronic gadget that her brother used. Her voice came from the heart of this fine, small brooch, yet the sound synchronized with her lip movements. This was one of the refinements of the gadget. Never were lip movements out of phase with the sound. Satura had a good-natured twinkle in his eye. Seeking to prove a theory, I suddenly spoke to him in Spanish. He answered without hesitation. His Spanish was correct, the accent perfect, the grammar excellent. However, there was one significant point. There is a whole range of Spanish accents, depending upon whether the language is spoken in Spain itself, in Argentina, in Colombia or in Cuba. There is, of course, little difference between the Spanish of Mexico and that of Peru. As I have already mentioned, I am fluent in Spanish, for I have made many business trips to most of the major countries where that language is spoken. So I am aware of the regional differences of the language. Of course, one has to stay a long time in any one of the countries to speak the language correctly and idiomatically. I persisted with my experiment, continuing to speak in Spanish, but ringing the changes, so that at one time I spoke as though I were a native of Spain, the next of Peru. Satura and Xiti reacted to the implicit challenge. Their facial expressions changed as I altered my intonation. I could see their puzzlement reflected in their eyes. They looked at each other intently, as though they were listening to strange, unknown sounds, and were trying to identify them. They seemed to be caught in some mental activity induced by imagined sensory impressions that were causing them some tension and ill feeling. Immediately, they switched back into English. Thus I knew that they were not truly polyglot, but were relying on some mechanical device, and the only mechanical device visible was the gadget worn by Satura and the brooch by Xiti. But they were innocent of wires or batteries, of circuits or valves. By this time, I had recovered my normal composure. Human nature being what it is, inevitably I paid more attention to Xiti than I did to her brother. Of course, I was never discourteous, and he made his contribution to the conversation. I suppose that I am attracted to the exotic in the female of the species, and Xiti had exoticism in the highest degree. If I were a professional writer, I might be able to probe in depth my feelings that night when I first met Xiti. I might be able to find words that matched the beauty of that Indian night and the greater beauty of that glorious woman. Let the thought pass for the deed, for those feelings indeed men usually keep to themselves and don't go shouting about the rooftops. The man in the street, that mythical ordinary man from Lima to Lhasa, would blush with humiliation at the thought that his most intimate thoughts were being given vocal expression. Xiti's self-assurance, her rigid self-discipline, her exoticism, that hint of mystery about her, that incomparable beauty, all these kindled within me basic masculine desire. This must have been only too apparent at times, but Xiti's air of charm, of being in control of the situation never deserted her for one moment. I was eventually glad about this, for I discovered that she did not react in the way that I reacted. Not that she was free of desires, but this was neither the time nor the place to express them, nor was it the right technique to employ. For we humans are peculiar people. We can make love, the summit of human affection, in the midst of the most terrible human suffering, in the depths of human despair. We can copulate, then dash off in an airplane and kill a few hundred women and children with napalm and high explosives, then rush back and start making love all over again. Our surroundings do not mean very much to us when our sexual appetites need quenching. This is all supposed to be perfectly normal behavior in the human animal. Any healthy man who acted differently would soon find himself on the psychiatrist's couch, or behind prison bars. But as I found out with Xiti, she and others like her are made differently. Or rather, they are not brainwashed or conditioned to this form of behavior. With them, there is an absolute isolation of the spirit from the carnal body. Love cannot exist where there is hate, despair or suffering, and love in this context includes the physical act of love. But as the evening wore on, my contribution to the conversation became less and less as I thought more and more about the extraordinary situation in which I had found myself. Chapter 3. the human comedy, Painless Death. The following morning, I wanted to be alone in order to think over the extraordinary affair of Satu Ra City and Itibi Ra too.